This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, June 23, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. Iranian authorities say there were no major irregularities in the recent presidential elections, while world leaders criticize the Islamic Republic for its tough handling of the protesters. In Washington, immigrant groups ask Congress to help them to legalize their status. And we go to Brazil, where indigenous communities are working to maintain their own education system. All these stories and more after this news.
I'm Nell Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. According to the United Nations, another 40,000 Pakistanis have fled South Waziristan in recent days. They joined the nearly 2.5 million who left the Swat Valley seeking safety during military operations against the Taliban. In South Waziristan, farming is often the sole source of income, and it is the season to harvest crops and fruit. After the harvest, most people are expected to leave the region. Amongst this backdrop, U.S. drones dropped missiles in South Waziristan today. Nathan Moore reads for our correspondent in the region, Gabe Matthews.
This morning, an unpiloted U.S. aircraft, or drone, fired missiles near the main town in South Waziristan, the home territory of Pakistan Taliban chief Baitullah Masood. At least 6 people were killed. Hours later, drones struck once again, their target this time, the funeral prayers for those who died in the earlier attack. On condition of anonymity, a young man spoke with FSRN from South Waziristan.
Many people were present at the funeral of a commander who was killed in a U.S. attack. In the morning, we heard a huge sound. Everyone understood it was a U.S. drone. People here are used to hearing the huge sounds of U.S. drone attacks. Most of the local people want to leave this area, but they can't leave because of their poverty. I believe many innocent civilians are among the dead. It is our culture and religious teaching that most people attend funeral prayers, so it does not mean that all killed would be militants.
Reports indicate as many as 50 were killed in the attack on the mourners. There are also reports today that the main rival of Taliban leader Baitullah Masood, Qari Zainuddin, was assassinated this morning. Those reports are unconfirmed. Pakistan's government had supported Zainuddin as part of their effort to overthrow Masood's control in the region. Reading for Gabe Matthews in Pakistan, I'm Nathan Moore.
Thousands of people continue protesting today in Andahuaylas in the Andean region of Peru. Pamela Cueva has more.
Andahuaylas is now isolated. For 12 days, protesters have blockaded the main roads and airport. Campesinos and labor unions are demanding the construction of an interregional road. Today, the protesters will meet with Prime Minister Yehude Simons. Protests throughout the highlands, like the one in Andahuaylas, followed the deadly protests in the Amazon basin earlier this month. They are destabilizing the Alan Garcia government. Tomorrow, the Prime Minister will appear before the National Congress to explain the reasons for the Amazonian crisis. A no-confidence vote could follow. The government has authorized military intervention to guarantee the public order and safety in Apurimac, Cusco, and Junin. For FSRN, Pamela Cueva and Alfredo Cuadros, Lima.
Palestinian Man News Agency reported today that a prisoner swap deal between Hamas and Israel is likely very soon. Meanwhile, scores of families of Palestinian prisoners demonstrated today, demanding the release of about 12,000 prisoners jailed by Israel. Hundreds of Israelis counter-protested, calling for the release of an Israeli soldier captured in Gaza. Free Speech Radio News' Rami El-Magari reports.
For more than 2 years now, Gaza-based families of 950 Palestinians jailed in Israel have not been allowed to visit their family members. Elderly Om Imad Shahada is a mother of a Gaza prisoner. Her son Imad and her brother Hatim Ismail have been imprisoned for almost 20 years.
I haven't seen my son for about 3 years. It is unfair. It is unfair. They are demonstrating to demand Shalit. At least, they should allow us to see our children.
According to Israeli online Haaretz, hundreds of Israelis counter-protested inside Israel near the Gaza crossings, demanding the release of captured Israeli soldier Gilad Shalit, who has been held by two Gaza factions since June 2006. Also today, Israel released the speaker of the Hamas-dominated parliament in the West Bank, Dr. Aziz Dwake. Dwake was jailed in 2006 along with dozens of other Hamas members following Hamas's capture of Shalit. Egyptian-mediated talks between Israel and the ruling Hamas party in Gaza are ongoing. They include a prisoner swap deal. Hamas wants 1,000 Palestinian prisoners in return for extraditing Shalit. Israel refuses. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
The National Prison Rape Elimination Commission says that 60,000 prison inmates in the U.S. are raped each year. More than half said their abuser was prison staff. According to a report issued today, inmates most at risk are those who are young, short, gay, or female. More rape occurs in prisons than in jails, and some prisons are far worse than others. The commission identified standards for implementation. Their recommendations go to Attorney General Eric Holder. Among them, better identification of potential victims, staff training, and zero tolerance policies. Once adopted, if prisons don't implement recommended policies, they could lose 5% of federal prison grant funds. For Free Speech Radio News from WMNF Community Radio in Tampa, I'm Nell Abram.
Iran's powerful Guardian Council declared that the country's disputed presidential election results will stand, saying it could find no evidence of any major irregularities. Iranian authorities say President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad won the election with more than 60% of the vote, but supporters of opposition candidates continue to claim the elections were rigged. Protests over the last week have turned violent. At least 13 people have died, but accurate counts are difficult to come by due to restrictions on the press. Iran's supreme leader, the Ayatollah Khamenei, ordered a halt to protests last week, urging opposition leaders to handle their complaints through Iran's legal system. The government's handling of the protests has outraged many world leaders, including those in neighboring Israel. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu praised the courage of Iranian protesters today and called the Tehran authorities the greatest threat to peace. In Europe, French President Nicolas Sarkozy called the elections a tragedy, adding that the extent of fraud is proportional to the violent reaction. British Prime Minister Gordon Brown spoke today before the parliament.
The onus is on Iran to show the Iranian people that recent elections have been credible and that the repression and curtailment of democratic rights that we've seen in the last few days will cease. We too have an expectation of Iran that it meets its obligations as a member of the international community. I hope that Iran will respond to our efforts to achieve a genuine dialogue.
Iranian authorities accuse Britain and other Western powers of interfering in Iran's internal affairs and of attempting to divide the country. Today, Iran expelled two British diplomats after accusing them of espionage. The U.S. reaction to the event in Iran has been more measured. At a press conference today, Obama said the U.S. will not be a foil for the Iranian government, adding that some people would love to blame what's happening on the streets of Tehran on the CIA or on the White House.
This is an issue that is led by and given voice to the frustrations of the Iranian people. And we're going to continue to be consistent in saying this is not an issue about the United States. This is about an issue of the Iranian people. What we've also been consistent about is saying that there are some universal principles, including freedom of assembly and freedom of speech, making sure that governments are not using coercion and violence and repression in terms of how they interact with peaceful demonstrators. And we have been speaking out very clearly about that fact.
While Obama urged Iran to respect human rights and used his strongest language to date, he didn't talk about any specific U.S. response. Conservative lawmakers in the U.S. have criticized the Obama administration's softer tone in response to the events in Iran, but some analysts say the administration's measured reaction is due in part to negotiations over Iran's nuclear program. After all, the U.S. is trying to convince the Islamic Republic to stop its experiments with nuclear technology. Meanwhile, in Iran, authorities announced plans to set up a special court to try protesters, warning that those who encourage more demonstrations will be subject to arrest. Two groups of immigrants spoke out on Capitol Hill today asking Congress to help them legalize their status. Widows of American citizens and college-bound students, all in legal limbo, are looking for a better solution than deportation. Tanya Snyder reports.
Natalia Gukasian is a 23-year-old widow from Russia. Her husband, a U.S. citizen, developed a rare cancer while serving in the U.S. military and died. Gukasian got survivor's benefits from the military, but then immigration agents denied her visa application.
Military determined me eligible for benefits, but immigration didn't.
She had been sure that her application would be accepted, especially given her husband's military service.
I was told the only way for me is to, you know, just withdraw it. That's no other choice option. I have to withdraw my petition for permanent residency, as there is no way in the law that will allow me to adjust my status.
An obscure law, which some call the widow penalty, rejects visa applicants if they've been married to their U.S. citizen spouses for under 2 years when their spouse dies. Lawmakers and spouses drew attention to the issue Tuesday in D.C. on International Widows Day. Massachusetts Democrat Jim McGovern has introduced a bill in the House to change the law.
There is no reason why people who have followed the rules, filled out the paperwork, and waited in line should be denied their right of obtaining citizenship. The current system punishes people for the untimely death of their spouse.
The Department of Homeland Security issued a 2-year suspension of the widow penalty 2 weeks ago, but the would-be immigrants are still left in a legal limbo. Deportation proceedings have been halted, but they still don't have legal status.
And as it is right now, she can't drive, she can't work, she can't go back to college.
Stephanie Prettle is the mother-in-law of Ellen Prettle, a young woman from the Philippines whose husband, Stephanie's son, died in his sleep at age 33. Prettle is fighting for Ellen's right to stay in the country.
Going back is not an option. I'm not going to lose my other child and my grandchild. It's just not an option.
Meanwhile, undocumented students gathered by the Senate buildings for a mock graduation ceremony. Hundreds of young immigrants, most of them Latino, came to the Capitol to support the DREAM Act, a bill that was first introduced in 2001 but still hasn't passed. The DREAM Act would grant permanent residency to high school graduates who were brought to the U.S. illegally as minors. If they stay out of trouble with the law and either go to college or join the military, they get legal status. That would help students like Dulce Salazar. Her family came to the U.S. from Mexico when she was 8 to get medical treatment for her little sister, who has heart problems.
You know, my parents, their plan wasn't to stay here, but because it was just easier rather than be driving back and forth seeing specialists, and that was going to be expensive, and you know, it's expensive to be at the hospital, so they had to be working as well. They decided to stay here as a result.
She tries not to think about the very real possibility that she could be deported back to Mexico.
But if I really had to think about it, I mean, I think that would be one of the hardest things that can happen to me. I haven't been to Mexico in, I want to say, over 10 years. Most of my life has been spent in the U.S. My sister's life have been spent in the U.S. If we were to be back, we wouldn't know what to do. I guess start all over.
It may be too late for Walter Lara. When asked where he's from, he answers,
supposedly from Argentina.
The United States is the only home he's known. He came to the country when he was 3. He just graduated from Miami-Dade Honors College with a degree in computer animation.
4 months ago, I got caught by immigration, and I'm actually getting deported, and I have to go there within 2 weeks.
Lara's classmate Felipe, who preferred not to give his last name, is grateful to Miami-Dade Community College for admitting undocumented students. Not all universities do. There's just one problem.
I had to pay 4 times as much as anybody else because I had to pay out-of-state fees. So for example, a resident will pay $200 per class. I had to pay $800, close to $900.
The DREAM Act is currently stalled in the Senate Judiciary Committee, which so far has been too busy working on the confirmation of the first Hispanic Supreme Court justice to move it forward. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
Yesterday, the Supreme Court sidestepped a challenge to the Voting Rights Act, which protects voters in historically racist districts. The court upheld the act in an 8-1 decision, but the opinion by Chief Justice Roberts raised questions about the validity of the 15th Amendment, nearly 50 years after its adoption. FSRN's Matt Pearson reports.
The Supreme Court ruled nearly unanimously on Monday to allow a utilities district in Texas to bail out of preclearance requirements under the Voting Rights Act. When that act passed in Congress in 1965, one part of it, Section 5, designated that certain state and local districts with long histories of racial discrimination would need congressional approval in order to change voting procedures. The Texas Utility District was suing to be removed from coverage by Section 5, claiming the preclearance mandates were unconstitutional and should be overturned. On Monday, the justices, with only Clarence Thomas in dissent, offered the district the opportunity to pursue a bailout from preclearance, but sidestepped the constitutional question. Advocates for the Voting Rights Act are calling the decision a victory. Kristen Davis is with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
This case was brought precisely for the purpose of tearing out the heart of the Voting Rights Act. And here the plaintiffs failed in that effort. The court rejected the constitutional challenge, and Section 5 now remains in place to protect minority voters in many places around the country where discrimination continues to be a problem.
In his opinion, Justice Roberts questioned whether the current conditions continue to justify legal sanctions that were put in place at a time of perhaps more potent discrimination. But Davis calls America's racial gains, including the election of America's first black president, fragile. She says the threat of racial discrimination is as real today as ever.
Every redistricting plan for the state legislature in Louisiana has been rejected, found to be discriminatory under the Voting Rights Act in the last four decades. The same holds true for Texas. Every redistricting plan adopted there found to be discriminatory over the last three decades.
The onus to decide the constitutionality of the law now falls to Congress. Myrna Perez, counsel at NYU's Brennan Center for Legal Justice, believes that is right where the authority should lie.
The framers, you know, of the Reconstruction Congress thought that we needed the 15th Amendment because we needed to have Congress having a consistent role. A role that in case, you know, electoral majorities changed or in case the violence and intimidation that people were doing in response to the formal legal changes got to be too much, Congress needed to have continuing authority. You know, there's a unique role set out for Congress, not the courts.
A district utility board is a relatively small jurisdiction to apply for bailout from preclearance requirements. Now that the court has approved the bailout application of this one, experts expect many other jurisdictions to try in Congress. Matt Pearson, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
New York Governor David Paterson convened a special session of the state Senate today in an effort to undo a long power struggle between Democrats and Republicans. The Senate is split in half and has failed to vote on several important bills during its regular session. One proposal that's still on the table is a bill that will hold medical professionals accountable for their role in the mistreatment and torture of detainees at military prisons or detention centers like Guantanamo Bay. Ravi Ragbir with the Community News Production Institute has more.
So this is a letter that Mohammed wrote to us in December. This was after his cutting.
Center for Constitutional Rights, Deborah Popowski, reads a recent letter sent from Guantanamo Bay detainee, Mohammed Khan Toumani.
I want to tell you that my mental state is such that I cannot sleep and cannot eat food. A few days ago, on Friday, December 20th, 2008, I cut a vein in my left hand until blood poured all over my chest and filled the room. On the wall, I wrote, "Country of Injustice is America," to protest a number of things. Number one, being in this place, having been arrested when I was 17 years old. Two, the continuous psychological pressure and the torture that I currently endure. Three, the torture endured by prisoners in general, but especially the Syrians. Four, being apart from my father. And five, the current general torture. For example, 3 days ago, the soldiers mishandled the Quran.
Mohammed Khan Toumani is one of dozens of detainees at Guantanamo whose inhumane interrogation, mistreatment, and psychological abuse was assisted by medical professionals working for the military. Gitanjali Gutierrez, a lawyer with the Center for Constitutional Rights, has advocated on behalf of another detainee, Muhammad Al-Qahtani. She is trying to bring the health professionals involved in detainee mistreatment to justice.
In the case of Muhammad Al-Qahtani, the medical professionals who were in the room during his interrogations were not there to make his life easier or to save his life. The medical professionals that were going into the room and taking his vital signs and clearing him for further interrogations, or the medical professionals who were going in to administer IVs, knowing that he would be strapped down and left those individuals were participating in his torture. And I think that hiding behind the excuse that they had a dual loyalty to the military and to their profession is ignoring the fact that here is someone whose treatment met a legal definition of torture. It met a medical standard that he was in severe pain and suffering, and that they did nothing. And not only did they do nothing, they participated in it.
In New York, human rights activists and concerned medical professionals are calling for an end to the involvement of medical professionals in coercive interrogations and torture. A bill introduced this year by New York State Assembly member Richard Gottfried looks to bring sanctions against medical professionals that are explicitly or implicitly involved in torture. Dr. Stephen Reisner with Physicians for Human Rights is a proponent of the bill.
The Gottfried bill is a bill that prohibits health professionals from being involved in abuse, in torture, in interrogations of any prisoner, domestic or in national security detention centers or in military prisons. So it says no health professional can be involved in torture or abuse of prisoners, period, end of story, or they will lose their license.
The legislation has bipartisan support and is co-signed by 23 lawmakers. There is also a companion bill in the Senate. If passed, according to the advocates of the bill, it would be the first in the country to allow state legislation to bring sanctions against health professionals who violate ethics codes. The Center for Constitutional Rights leads the campaign in support of the bill. Again, campaign organizer Deborah Popowski.
What we want people to understand is accountability is important. It's also important to realize that this is still happening. It's not, as the president has said and others have said, that it's not worth looking into the past. What happened in the past is still happening today and will happen again in the future. If we don't pass this legislation, if the licensing boards don't sanction, then there is nothing to tell these health professionals in the future and the ones that are there now that they should stop what they're doing and they should never do it again.
The bill points out that the issue of healthcare professionals facilitating torture is not limited to a few individuals, but is a systemic problem facilitated by official policy. The bill is one of many currently stalled by the political deadlock in Albany. Rick Christopher Rios, I'm Ravi Ragbir, Free Speech, Radio News, New York.
Brazil's 1988 constitution, written after the end of its military dictatorship, recognized the rights of indigenous people to have their own schools. Since then, experience has shown that it takes more than words on paper to transform this and other rights into reality. Zoe Sullivan reports.
Since Brazil's new constitution was enacted in 1988, the federal government has signed various laws supporting the creation of schools for indigenous communities. These schools, which have substantial autonomy, offer communities the opportunity to shape their own educational agenda. Tribal leaders and community members decide on the subjects and content to include in school curricula. As a result, schools are often multilingual, teaching native languages and Portuguese, as well as intercultural. Communities also choose the teachers, with preference usually given to indigenous teachers who live in the villages where they teach. Not only does this facilitate the sharing of cultural knowledge with the students, but the coordinator of indigenous education in the state of Bahia also noted that indigenous teachers demonstrate a greater commitment to work within their communities. The Northeast was the first part of the country colonized by the Portuguese. As a result, the indigenous peoples of the Northeast have the longest history in Brazil of resistance to European domination. José Augusto Sampaio is a professor of anthropology at the State University of Bahia. While noting a rich history of struggle by indigenous peoples in the Northeast, he sees cultural forces still in conflict.
So there is a war. There is a war between different models of society and models of development. On the one hand, there is a society that wants to occupy even more territory, that wants to generate wealth for the market, particularly for the foreign market. And on the other hand, there are traditional societies that try communal solutions and that practice a more sustainable economy based on producing foodstuffs, mostly for local use. This is the dispute: two models of society and two models of development.
Dos modelos de sociedade, dos modelos de desenvolvimento.
Although some indigenous nations have managed to officially obtain land guarantees from the government, sometimes displacing European Brazilians, land remains one of the most contentious issues for native peoples in Brazil. Raposo Serra do Sol, an area designated by the Brazilian government for indigenous people in the northern part of the country, made international headlines earlier this year when European Brazilian rice farmers refused to leave their plantations. Sampaio notes that the agricultural industry that makes Brazil a leading producer of sugarcane, soy, and cellulose labels indigenous people as lazy because they only produce what they need instead of exploiting their land for profit. Rosalini Cruz, who is a member of the Toxá Nation, works for the state of Bahia as the coordinator for indigenous education. Indigenous education today serves to manage the community's subsistence, its survival. So education today is a support mechanism for constructing policies that guarantee the community's sustainability. Indigenous teachers face a variety of obstacles. Access to education is one of the first hurdles. Indigenous teachers with a college degree are rare, and while most have finished high school, many have not. This situation is, in some ways, similar to that of non-indigenous teachers in Brazil. According to a study released last month by a research institute connected to the Brazilian Ministry of Education, 600,000 students are being taught by teachers who have only an eighth-grade education. Another difficulty for native teachers is the cost associated with higher education, which is only available in urban areas away from indigenous lands. Although there are quotas to ensure that indigenous students have places in the universities, tuition is relatively expensive, and there are the costs of travel and living away from home. Paula Batista de Almeida is a Kiriri teacher in the community of Mirandela. She and other indigenous teachers were forced to abandon their studies because of the cost. She spoke with FSRN at a teacher's training in a village near Mirandela.
It's only private for those who want to study. You have to pay. Your salary is 300 reais. In college, you have to pay 260. So we end up with practically nothing. What are you going to live on if what you earn you spend paying for school? And so we stopped asking the government for help, and no help has arrived.
Batista de Almeida says discrimination also makes campus life difficult for indigenous students. Brazil's Ministry of Education reports that 170,000 children are enrolled in 2,500 indigenous schools throughout the country. Yet, only one out of every 17 children who finishes elementary school continues on to an indigenous secondary school. Advocates see indigenous schools as a way to strengthen native voices in the country's political processes. Brazil is home to more than 200 distinct original peoples, and each school is shaped to meet the needs and vision of that community to reinforce a pluralistic representation of Brazil rather than a homogeneous one. Zoe Sullivan, FSRN, Salvador.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. Today's newscast was produced by Catherine Comp and Vinod K. Joes. Headlines editor is Nell Abram, and the technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Rose Katapchi and Puck Lowe. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.